You're listening to the Eurofolk Radio Network, and this is the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And returning with me today is my regular guest and good friend, Dr. Eric Karlstrom. So I'm going to bring him up right now. Eric, are you with me?
Yeah. Hi, Andy. Good to be with you again.
Excellent. Well, it's always great to do the shows that we do together, and we've got another one coming up that we've already booked, folks. So Eric is always welcome on this program whenever he would like to be on. He does fantastic work across a wide variety of spectrum. And today our show is political correctness. We're going to start the show off with one of Eric's songs, which relates to this subject. It's called Svenska Studies. Now, before I play it, Eric, can you give the listeners the background to this song, when you wrote it, etc.? Over to you.
Yeah, you know, I taught 30 years at the university system in America, the last 22 years of which were at California State University. Stanislaus in the Central Valley of California. And during this time, I noticed, certain political trends. The political correctness issue got more and more kind of in your face. So I would have written this song as kind of a spoof response to the political correctness movement. Oh, gosh, I think probably in the early 2000s. You know, we have all these, special feminist studies and Latin studies and Black studies. And anyway, the song pretty much tells the story. And here's a guy who's a guy from Sweden. And he's working on the grounds crew, and he's just scratching his head trying to figure out what in the world's going on. There's no place for him.
Excellent. Right. Okay. Without further ado, then we'll play the song, which will lead us into the show. So here we go, folks.
Well, I work for a big corporation. Verde ting, but we sells education. Some factories churn out the cheese. This factory sells college degrees. I work on the outside grounds crew. Sometimes I move furniture too. Someday I might go back to school and get my diploma too. Well, a degree is a mighty swell thing. It could help you get a job and everything. Or you could frame it and put it up on your wall. Yeah, you'd never regret it at all. I think the students love this place. And why not? 'Cause they all get good grades. These days the customer always is right. No need to study or read and write. There's just one problem with the spell program here. One thing that to me don't seem fair. How come we got all these special studies for just a select few minorities? We got Hispanic and women's studies for you. African and Native American too. That's well for them, and I don't want to be rude, but we Swedish Americans are a minority too. Well, I'm a third generation Swedish American, and I just can't find my roots. Well, I've been to the Scandi Fest and I've tasted lutefisk, but those grand Viking days are true. Well, my Swedish is terrible, my English unbearable, and my Swenglish is just a spoof. Seems no one wants to hire me, 'cause I'm in the wrong minority. I got the Swedish American blues. So I put a suggestion in a suggestion box. I asked the president to call me up and talk. I said, if you want ethnic diversity, we need to offer Svenska studies. And I got ideas about curriculum. The courses should be easy and fun. We could sample the Swedish cuisine, pickled herring and lufsa and meat. and we could watch Swedish movies too. That Ingrid Bergman makes me come unglued. And then before we get settled down, we make like Vikings and pillage the town. Well, I didn't hear from the president, so I sat down and wrote her again. And this time in my letter I stressed that we Swedes have been oppressed. I said we Swedes have had it tough. Them Minnesota winters can be rough. And no matter how far our ancestors came, we still live near Norwegians and Danes. Another thing that really gets me inflamed, though you know I don't like to complain, it's a shame how our women folks got to put up with all them blonde yokes. And I'm a third generation Swedish American, and I just can't find my roots. Though I've been to the Scandifest, and I've eaten lutefisk, and found it tastes like glue. I know sex, Sven and Ole yokes that I tell to Norwegian folks to keep them all amused. And not in Gortungafjet and Kringjord and Soferlet, even Santa Lucia's confused. Well, the president didn't write me back, so I figured I'd better take a new tack. And this time I appeal to the one thing she cares for, it's the thing that she just can't ignore. I said my sick, rich Uncle Sven, he'll bequeath all his fortune to them. Well, she called me back the very same day and said, yeah, sure, you betcha, by Yemeni, you'll get your Institute of Svenska Studies right away. Well, I work in a big corporation, where the thing but we sells education. Now that we got Svenska Studies here, I think I go back to school next year.
Excellent, Eric. Very good, very amusing, and very on point. What have you? Can any comments on the song, please?
Well, yeah, this song is included on a CD I've put together called University Days, D-A-Z-E, and it's actually for sale on my erickarlstrom.com website, which has about 15 or so CDs that I've made over the years. And since I've retired in 2011, I've made a number of additional CDs. That one was kind of therapy for me as I was going through some tenure struggles. we can get into that if you want. Tenure is you know, whether you live or die at the university, whether you stay and go up the ladder, or whether you're kicked out. So, yeah, this seemed to me that we still had freedom of speech, at least freedom to write songs, and I would kind of, my therapy would be to write a series of songs, and all of those songs are on University Days CD, and another one's on Talkin' RPT Blues CD, a 30-minute song that explains, that gives the details of my tenure struggles there. But yeah, one of the issues, of course, is this political correctness thing, which, you know, this is a form of cultural Marxism. We talked about this before, Andy, when we did a show on the Frankfurt School and cultural Marxism, which I'm actually very happy with. I think we got a lot of good points out on that, and I know you have it archived. And so this is just, hopefully our discussion today can talk about how this has manifest as a kind of a thought control system on campuses, you know, gosh, since I really began my academic career. You know, I started university in 1967. I got my degree in 1971. By that time, it was already established. A lot of these, certainly feminism was the new ism, and environmentalism was already coming on strong at that point. As I got through my master's and my doctorate, I pretty much ignored those things because I was working on physical geography, which is, you know, basically science. And it has little to do, hopefully, with these isms. But even these isms then are even science then, as we've talked about earlier, has been corrupted by these isms in the form of the global warming scare, which, of course, is political and not scientifically based. And then more recently at Cal State University, you know, if you weren't a feminist when I started teaching in 1991 at Cal State University, you better watch out. You might not get tenure. And indeed, I had some real struggles. And if you weren't an environmentalist, by golly, you better watch out. So what had happened is that, you know, the universities, which hopefully had been always more concerned about educating and giving information that was, you know, applicable and useful to students as they go on through their careers. The mission, especially when I reached California in 1991, was to change the way people perceive the world. And this is very consistent with the United Nations core curriculum ideas that outcomes-based education. We want the students to look at the world a certain way. So you will now graduate, and you will have a feminist, environmentalist, and multicultural point of view. And you will get this propaganda inculcated in you in the courses at the university where you go. So you're paying money as a student to be brainwashed, essentially, in a series of values which you could call them the elites, want to impose from on high. And it was more than that, because every job that I've ever looked at since my career began in 1981, jobs in geography journal, also got the little caveat at the end of the ad: we are an equal opportunity employer, women and minorities are encouraged to apply, which means, all things being equal, they have to hire the woman and the minority or the minority person. This is called the affirmative action, you know, kind of thing. So when I started teaching, say, at Cal State University, we were a small geography department of three males and a female. When I left, we were a small geography department of, three females and a African. When I left, there was no more white. There was no more white male presence, except for the couple part timers. So the full, the tenure track, the associate full professors would all be the females. So this is a gigantic social engineering project that has occurred over the course of my adulthood, and yours, of course, Andy, and most people that are listening, and. It's all been quite deliberate, and that's, I think, what we need to talk about. And that's why I wanted to refer back to our earlier program on cultural Marxism and the Frankfurt School.
Yes, and we can also refer back to our last program on man-made climate change fraud, because in that program you talked us through getting tenure as a full professor and how it was a struggle for you due to your views on climate change. Now, with reference to your song that we just played, Svenska Studies, was there any other reason that your tenure was blocked for, like, political views, for resistance to political correctness? I think it's worth going through that journey that you took as well, just to explain to the listeners if indeed your progression to full tenured professor was ever blocked by other people at the university simply because you had a different political view to them.
Well, gosh, I mean, you don't know what you're asking here, Andy. Maybe you do. We could spend the next six shows talking about this, and we could play my Talking RPT Blues 30-minute song. We could RPT stand in for retention, promotion, and tenure, which is the file that you present to your department, and then it goes up the ladder to a university tenure committee, and then it goes up to the dean and the provost and the president, you know, all these things. There's all these levels of scrutiny, And, you know, it begins at the department level. So if you have alienated anybody in the department, one way or the other, perhaps by, you know, your even by your belief system, for instance, I wasn't a feminist, you know, and the person who came after me hardest was, I guess you'd call her a bull dyke feminist. Now, that's, you know, correlation does, what is it, causation does not cause correlation. Or, you know, we can't, we can correlate that, or correlation does not prove causation. But, you know, why this person was kind of out to destroy my career, you know, it could have been from, you know, orders from higher up. You don't know. But I can say for sure that she was a very kind of angry feminist, and I was a bit of a holdout in that regard. I mean, I just was not ideologically correct in that sense, you know. And it's not that I went out and, you know, did anything about that. It's just that I made it known that I wasn't totally on board with that ideology. I was teaching an environmental course, human ecology, and I was more or less politically correct about that for the first 10 years. But after I got tenure, I flip-flopped on that, and then I looked at the whole issue from the right-wing perspective and said, well, this is really propaganda too, isn't it? And then, of course, the last big push at my university, as well as others, is multiculturalism. Now we're going to have, you know... And all this, of course, works to just turn the power structure upside down, you know, as it's intended to do. If we go back to the cultural Marxism and the Frankfurt School, et cetera, we can identify whose ideas and philosophy are being implemented here and what the long-term objectives are. And the long-term objective is simply to overturn the power structure. They don't care about the emancipation of women. They don't care about the emancipation of the environment. And they don't care about the emancipation of minorities, blacks and Hispanics, et cetera. They really couldn't care less. These are ploys. These are tactics that were actually rather well laid out in Douglas Reed's book from 1956, by the way, The Controversy of Zion, in which he talks about the five stages of Zionism, or, you know, the Judaic conquest of the world. He talks about the emancipation phase between 1800 and 1900 AD as, you know, as the way to overturn the existing governmental structures, not because they really cared about the emancipation of women or the emancipation of blacks or anything else, but because this is a tactic. And of course, Marxism, of course, is, you know, the revolutionary movement, the worldwide revolutionary movement to overturn existing governments so that... you know, this Judaic power structure can take over. And then, of course, since 1900, according to Reed, we've been in the Zionist phase, in which world Zionism has become the dominant philosophy of the major governments, driving World War I, World War II, the other wars, and certainly now the wars in the Middle East, and the war on terror, and 9/11, which, of course, was orchestrated by these people, as we've indicated in another show, Andy. So, I mean, we start to see kind of the whole pattern emerging here, and the propagandization of America's youth, radicalization, propagandization, social engineering, if you will, as part of that larger project.
Yes, and I've been thinking, and we had a discussion before the show, that we can actually link political correctness to gang stalking. And I don't know if I've got a bit of a weak link here, but I'll give you an example of how I see it. When we're constantly walking on eggshells as to, oh, we can't say this, we can't say that, and one minute they're coloured people, then they're black people, then they're people of colour. I mean, it's absolute lunacy. And it's a restriction on our language. I mean, if you go back... I urge people to look at older television programmes. If they're going to watch television, get a DVD or a Blu-ray of something like an Archie Bunker, you know, and have a look at the sort of things that come out on these shows. And they become even funnier today because it's like, oh, but you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to say that. You know, why are you not allowed to say certain things? It's weaponizing language. And my feeling on it is that, of course, you said there that Marxism is a global, it's an international effort to basically topple the order of things. And if you're wanting to essentially create this mongrelized race as promised to us by Coudenhove Kalergi in his Practical Idealism book from 1924, which was sponsored by the Rothschild family through Warburg, and essentially have all white countries to become a mongrelized population which are run by Jews, then you can't have any sort of humour that could reflect on race. I'll give you an example. There was a programme, it was Till Death Us Do Part, and the lead character was Alf Garnett. And this ran in the UK during the 1960s through the 70s. And this was what became Archie Bunker in America. The idea was originally written for the UK, and the American TV networks liked it, and so they did their own version. Another programme came out called Love Thy Neighbour, and this was on ITV, the Alf Garnett show was a BBC, and this goes back to, I think, 1973, when there was only three television channels in the UK, there were no others available. And in that show, it was a white guy and a black guy that became neighbours, and the white guy's living there, and he's working at a factory, he's very working class. And then a black guy moves in, and he's like, oh, my God. And he phones up the race relations board to complain that he's got a nignog living next door and things like that. And the sort of things that go on, and they actually become, they're always having a go at each other. And the black guy calls him honky and the white guy calls him nignog or what have you. But they actually become friends and they end up working at the same factory. But whenever they sort of fall out, they have this banter with each other. And that sort of banter now is completely gone. And it's basically like, it's worse if you call someone a name than if you actually physically assault them. And with that in mind, and the fact that essentially there are elements of our vocabulary that are now criminalised, how would that tie in with gang stalking, in your opinion?
Well, I think it sets the stage, you know. I mean, you know, speaking of gang stalking, and I've got this website, gangstalkingmindcontrolcults.com. We're really talking about psychotronic warfare here. We're talking about neuro warfare, which is, I think, the warfare of the 21st century. And it's totally illegal, totally immoral, totally unconstitutional. And yet our government, the United States government, is waging it against its own citizenry, which is the highest act of treason that you can imagine. And I come to these radical, you know, declaratory statements through, you know, a lot of research and being a targeted individual myself and hearing from many other targeted individuals. And I think it's going on worldwide. It's not just the United States. It is based on, and this is coming from a black guy, and I watch lots of YouTubes on this topic, you know, to educate myself as well as read lots of books. Black guy, you know, and I mean, these people are going through hell deliberately. He said the whole system is based on hate. You know, my heart goes out to that guy. I know exactly what he's talking about. But yeah, so it's all divide and conquer stuff, you know. Women against men, the feminist movement, you know, hate. You know, we see the same thing in many of these, you know, separatist movements. You know, we're encouraged, the races are encouraged to hate each other. And if we can kind of up the level of hate, then we can get people involved in this program as a profession. We have professional surveillance role players. Sometimes they're called that, sometimes they're called perpetrators, sometimes they're called spotters. There's lots of people working on this at the street level. We have lots of people in universities doing neuroscience projects, you know, getting grants from the Pentagon and elsewhere to study and deconstruct and reconstruct the brain patterns of their fellow humans. I mean, this is all hatred. This is dehumanizing your fellow man, and so that, you know, whatever, you get more money or something like that, your survival now depends on this conducting of war against your fellow. Well, we're all conditioned kind of to do that sort of thing at the university, where we are programmed in these ways to again, the emancipation phase to the leaders, they don't care about the fate of the women or the blacks or anything like that. But they can use these things to divide and conquer. Get the women to hate the men. Get the men to hate the women. Get the blacks to hate the whites. This is all based on hatred. And the gang stalking is all based on hatred. It's based on trauma-based mind control, which is based on satanic ritual abuse, if you go back deep enough. And this is what's being done around the world now. So the people at the top who are executing these programs, I mean, they are, you know, what does national security mean? Potential terrorist threat mean? You talk about the corruption of the language. National security in practice means, you know, protecting the criminal syndicate at the top from exposure. Oh, it's a national security, ma'am. It's classified. We can't tell you this. You know, we can't tell you if you're on the terrorism watch list or not, because there's national security. Well, the people likely to be identified as terrorists are the people who are, you know, brave enough to criticize criminal activity in the government. And the government can't tolerate that. So we can't tolerate criticism, because if their apple cart were to be exposed for the horrors they've committed, even the rank and file population would turn on them. You know, so they have to keep a blanket over their own criminal activity. And so what they do, of course, is they cover up their last crime with their next crime. You know, this is a pattern. It goes way, way back. The psychotronics war thing is the big deal. I mean, that's the that's what's coming down on humanity. And it's been done secretly. It's, you know, the Soviets have been very much involved in it, and there's a record of that. And the United States has kept it secret. But all this goes back to just the post-World War II era and the MK Ultra mind control experiments, the electronic stimulation of the brain experiments of Dr. Jose Delgado, you know, Harvard-educated guy from Spain. But yeah, I mean, a whole myriad of neuroscientists have been working on these. This is the ultimate sin against your fellow man, is to try to steal his mind, take away his independent thought. But of course, as you go through the university system, you're programmed now. As this is going back to your point, Andy's long-winded. You are programmed now to really restrict your thoughts. You know, this is thought control. You know, you can't say this. You know, it starts off innocent. You can't say this, or you get a bad grade, you know, or your teacher yells at you, or you get expelled or something like that. I mean, there's certain, now it's called hate speech, you know, or something like that. When the greatest haters are the people who are accusing you of hate speech, you know, and who want to protect their criminal cabal, their syndicate, from exposure. So it's a way of cowering the domestic population into submission, as is, you know, the gang stalking. This is a way of, just like, you know, in the Phoenix program in the Vietnam War, this is a way of neutralizing the civilian population, terrorizing them into submission to the occupying force, which, of course, was the United States government. And now, when I'm talking about the occupying force that owns the United States government, and we talked about that, Andy, in our discussion about 9/11, it is pretty clear to me, not coming from any kind of ideological basis whatsoever, but just researching the 9/11 event, that yes, it was an inside job. Yes, it was interagency with all sectors of this, of our society involved. And yes, the Jews did it. Now that's really hard to get you to wrap your mind around until you start to understand that, as Ariel Sharon bragged in October of 2001, we, the Jews, control America, and the Americans know it. Well, he was right.
He was, and I think it's worth throwing in this Chris Hedges quote, Eric, that you may have heard. And here it is. And people have made this into memes as well. I'm not sure who Chris Hedges is. I understand he's quite an educated person, what have you. I did look him up. But anyway, here's the quote. He says, "We now live in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and banks destroy the economy." What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, this is Orwellian. It's beyond Orwellian language. It's actually now in practice, you know. George Orwell was right on about these things, you know, and how our society, you know, which is governed now from this cabal at the top and manipulated by this cabal at the top, you know, through their many, many institutions like the Frankfurt School, et cetera, the Tavistock Institute, and their many, many spinoffs and equivalents in the United States. This is a gigantic social engineering project. I'll give you something else, Andy, that I just read. One of the TIs shared it with me. There's a YouTube by a guy named Dr. I think it's Mark Snyder, something like that. Michigan, East Michigan State economist, PhD, who has determined that the United States, $21 trillion has gone unaccounted for, $11 trillion of which of that is in the U.S. Army alone. And of course, there were $2.3 trillion that had gone missing, according to DOD Director Donald Rumsfeld, the day before 9/11. These gigantic programs are funded by these black budget operations that are off the books, and we can't find the money. Catherine Austin Fitz, who was the Assistant Secretary Director of HUD, has a website called The Solari Report. She's got a YouTube up, which I encourage people to watch, saying we need our $40 trillion in stolen unaccounted money back or we're doomed. You know, in other words, the people at the top are raking off this money and, you know, in shady deals. And they're just going for it now, Andy. They're just going for broke. And I think this gang stalking thing is part of it. I think these other things have led up to this. I think the gang stalking, psychotronic war, brain mapping issue is the huge one, because this has now the potential to give elites the power. Well, the elites now have the power to take out all dissenters. And well, let's say you're tired of paying Social Security to retirees. Well, we have ways, you know, secretly, silently, to take them out now. And people will never know, because these electronic weapons are invisible. What exactly, you know, took out Uncle Bill or you know, Aunt Fran, you know, whatever. So this power in the hands, I mean, this is the ultimate sin, if you ask me, against humanity, against God and the laws of God and man. But all these other things are prelude to that, you know, the mind control going on at universities through this, you know, social engineering project called, you know, thought control, political correctness. This is all prelude, I think, to this complete control of the thoughts and behavior of society, so that society can be turned into, well, it can either be genocided or it can be turned into a slave, I won't even say a slave race, a slave species. With transhumanism now, we can cull the herd with these programs, these gang stalking programs. I call God's new Gestapo for global organized gang stalking, neuro warfare groups, electronic surveillance, slavery, tracking, torture, and psyops operations. I know it's long, but it tells what it is. So, you know, the people of these, of our countries, of our nations, need to somehow reassert control over their governments. See, the governments are instituted among, by people in order to secure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, according to our Declaration of Independence. And now, and then it also says when governments become destructive of these ends, it is our responsibility to either alter or abolish them. It's certainly our responsibility now to call them on the carpet, to get new congressional hearings on these kinds of odious technologies. But it's also our incumbent upon us to find out where that $21 trillion went, as Dr. Mark Snyder's doing and Catherine Austin Fitz. It's also incumbent on us, the citizens, to point out the criminal activities of our government and to correct them, to try to correct them. And of course, now it is in the new world war, governments are targeting individuals and not nations. And of course, they're targeting the individuals that are questioning their power. And so there is a war going on. We outnumber them. If we can educate them, if we can educate the population, we have a chance. And of course, they own the mainstream media, so that's an uphill struggle. But we try, don't we, Andy?
We absolutely do. And I don't want to go off point, but I heard recently about this new thing called slaughter bots. Have you heard of that at all?
Yes, I got a YouTube about that. Again, you
go ahead. Yeah, tell the listeners about it. I didn't know. You see, my question was, is I'm not denying its existence, but when they've got all these other weapons that they're using on us through the gang stalking, do they really need these as well? But I'll hand over to you. You explain to the audience what they are and your opinion, please.
Yeah, well, you know, the Frankenstein's monster here is the Department of Defense, you know, as ruled by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. We have something like 17 and probably more intelligence agencies. and, you know, our Department of Defense has a budget of about $800 billion a year. And this has been true all through the Cold War, that the Defense Department, quote-unquote defense, we should call it the Murder Department, about half of all public funding has gone to the War Department, which they call the Defense Department. Of course, in 1961, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was a five-star general before he became president, warned, he said, beware of the military-industrial complex. It's not just DOD, it's all their corporate partners and sponsors. SAIC, Northrop Grumman, Martin Marietta, all these have their own capability. Each of these corporations has their capability of doing gang stalking, because they all have access to these very, very high technology, military technology things that are, you know, used in the NSA and the CIA, et cetera. Each branch of the military has this capacity to do gang stalking. So this is a way of, you know, terrorizing the domestic population into submission. Now, you asked about slaughter bots. Well, yeah. I mean, you've got this enormous amount of money going to all these corporations to find the latest, greatest ways to kill human beings, and one of them, of course, is this little slaughter bot drone thing that can, you know, be directed to smash into the forehead of any bad or any person who is deemed bad by, you know, whoever's giving the orders. And there's a graphic video on this YouTube out on this, which is actually portraying a guy who's selling this to a big crowd, and they're all cheering, you know. Okay, so now you've got a bunch of people, hey, great, you know, this can kill people, blah 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 blah. And this really has been the climate of our nation, you know, in the Cold War period of, you know, post-World War II to 1989, we were locked in this supposed death struggle with the Russians or the Soviets, and it was, you know, who can build the biggest, you know, bomb that's going to take out more and more people. This has become a culture which now has a culture of death, Cultura del Muerte, to use the Espanol, murder incorporated. What we have is a culture murder incorporated. And unless we can find some values that are greater than that, we deserve to be slaughtered. And of course, they can slaughter us now, you know, a thousand ways. You know, even back in the 80s, when the Beyond War movement was getting going, trying to bring down the nuclear standoff between Russia, Soviets, and the United States, you know, there was something like 50,000, you know, nuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs. And it could destroy the Earth, what, you know, 50 times, 100 times, who cares, you know, destroy civilization. Now, of course, the substitute for that is neural warfare and directed energy weapons, these secret, silent, Tesla-type weapons. And, you know, it's just insanity, you know, multiplied by, but the slaughter bots, yeah, I mean, this is one more way to slaughter people, and drones, of course, can do that, and yippee, you know, we can kill people all around the world. Aren't we great, you know? No, we're murderers, you know. 4 million Iraqis killed since 1991 in the Gulf War, that's my count, out of about 20, that's genocide by any count. And the country that did that, which, of course, we know who they are and who they're working for, deserve, you know, to pay. The nation that's doing the gang stalking, let's talk about paying, you know, recompense, redress. I mean, is there any possible amount of money that you could give somebody to make it right that you put them through hell for 20, 30 years of their life and then disposed of them in this program? No. But let's start talking about it. Let's start talking about, you know, a $5 million, $10 million price tag per targeted individual. The nation that did that is responsible for that. And we have to have justice. Who killed Kennedy? Well, we know now the CIA and the Mossad killed Kennedy. Has anybody ever gone to jail for that? No. Who did 9-1-1? We know now. You know, it was the interagency in the United States, you know, run by the CIA and Mossad and the Jewish Zionism. Nobody's gone to jail for that. We have to find justice. We have to find some criminals and lock them up. Otherwise, this thing just spirals and there's no end. And that's, I'm afraid, where we're at. The criminals are ruling, as the Ode to Jimmy says.
Yes.
My earliest thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did a whole show on that, which was very good. The audience can find that in the archives. I mean, the slaughter bots did interest me because I was wondering if this is something that they're, from my understanding, the way it was presented was it was more going to be something that countries were going to use on their domestic population. And so where you've got people that just won't go along with this politically correct program, who won't go along with the genocide of their own race and culture, this is the sort of thing that they could dispatch in one go and get, you know, a few key figures in the alternative media or nationalism or any groups that are opposed to the government's indoctrination and control of them, and just release it all in one fell swoop. Get a load of people at once. What do you think of that? Do you think that these are designed to be used at some point on domestic populations, or are they more likely to be deployed in places like Syria, for example?
Well, both. I mean, they always use these wars as a means of testing the new kill technique, you know, and the microwave weapons, you know, have been deployed, the voice-to-skull weapons have been deployed in Iraq, et cetera, and they also are deployed here. This is, you know, this is kind of the 1-2 punch. It goes back to the Vietnam War when we had the Phoenix program killing Vietnamese civilians who weren't happy with being invaded and occupied. And then we had the MH Chaos program operating simultaneously, which was to neutralize and surveil dissidents in the United States. The United States is a counterinsurgency nation, of course. Colonel Elcher Prouty, who wrote the book called The Secret Team, the CIA and its allies in control of the United States and the world. What that means is insurgents are designated, you know, like as in a terrorism watch list, a potential terrorist threat. Now we're going to find the citizens who, you know, might cause us some problems, who might influence public opinion in a way we don't like. We're going to call them insurgents. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do counterinsurgency, which is we're going to attack them. And when they don't die and they stand up and try to survive and fight back, then we're going to attack them some more. This is how you get enemies. And this is how the CIA has always gotten enemies in countries all around the world. You find the intellectuals, you find the people of influence, you attack them. And then you go do the counterinsurgency, or now we call it counterterrorism. That's kind of the umbrella term. But again, we're stuck with this Orwellian language, in which lies are embedded. You know, what's the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter? There's no difference. It depends on your perspective. You know, were the Mujahideen in Afghanistan terrorists or fighters? Well, on your perspective. Ronald Reagan said they were freedom fighters, the equivalent, moral equivalent of the founding fathers. We created them to kick the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Now we call them terrorists. You know, now we call ISIS and, you know, Al-Qaeda, and we call all these guys terrorists. We created them all. Mossad and CIA created them all to destabilize regions so that the imperial power, United States, or shall I say the Anglo-American, Israeli, can take the resources.
You're breaking up a bit, Eric. I don't know what happened. I got most of what you said. Let's just see if the line stabilizes, otherwise I can call you back. Well, actually, just to let you know, we've got about 8 minutes left, and I want to make sure that you get everything in that you wanted to. So is there anything else that you want to touch on in regard to political correctness that we haven't yet covered?
Yeah, but did you get what I said, that I was talking about how, you know, the corruption of language, creating our own enemy, you know, ISIS, Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, all these are creations of the CIA, you know, and Mossad. And this then gives the imperial powers the right to go in and wage war against those civilian populations in order to gather control over the resources. You know, this is the old colonial model. And but yeah, going back to the political correctness thing, form of thought control, and those professors who are on board, you know, who teach feminism, environmentalism, multiculturalism, etc., who are politically correct, tend to have a kind of their ladder is paved, and you know, it's easy for them to ascend, more or less. It's easier for them to you know, to stay and to thrive in the system. Those who don't, the professors who don't, will tend to be marginalized and weeded out. And this is true also of you know, getting grants, which, of course, professors have to get grants nowadays and publish in journals to get tenure and to survive the academic scrutiny of their peers, etc. Being out of the political correct mainstream it makes your career much more difficult and or impossible, I would say. So we have then a uniformity of thought, which is enforced by the system. And that's not good. That's not what a university is about. University is about a universal, you know, a collection of ideas and information. It should be a place where truth is sought in its various forms. But it has become, I'm afraid, kind of a thought control in many ways, a way to, you know, to channel human intellectual activity in certain directions and to prohibit the intellectual pursuit of other directions which are not deemed appropriate. So again, social engineering.
Yes, and one example that I always think of when they talk about how language, you touched on, about how they can change your interpretation of an event by merely adjusting the language, is when Israelis, the Israel IDF, stormed one of those flotilla ships that was delivering aid to Gaza and killed about 11 of the aid workers on there. And they obviously sat back and thought, how on earth can we justify this? You know, the media, the Jewish-owned media. And what they did, the BBC, is rather than refer to these people who were killed in cold blood when they were delivering food and medical supplies to Gaza, killed in cold blood, 11 of them, by Israeli IDF soldiers, they referred to them as activists rather than aid workers. You see, just that little change in the word, activist, it sounds, that's like a terrorist, isn't it? All activists, they were against the system, they were an activist. Whereas if you said that they were aid workers, then there's more likely to force a form of international condemnation, which never took place. Because, of course, we know all the governments around the world, certainly in white nations, are completely controlled by this entity. What are your thoughts on that, Eric?
I think that's an excellent point. You know, even just a slight tweak of spin there, you know, from aid workers to activists. Well, activist is a little closer to subversive, isn't it? You know, it's a little closer to terrorist or adversary. So we have all this language which allows us to kill others, targeted individuals. You know, it's not a person, it's a target. This military language, this massaging of the language, very, very pernicious. You know, Confucius was asked years ago, how to fix a lot of the problems in the realm, you know, the Chinese realm many years ago. He said, rectify the language. And that's a good point. I mean, we need to rectify the language. I mean, these aid workers were people with big hearts who were putting themselves in danger to help people. In other words, they were altruists. Maybe we should spin it that way. 11 altruists, saints. were killed by the Israeli forces, you know. I mean, that's the truth. But instead, they've spun it the other way.
They have. And, it's just amazing to see, you know, that these people will... There's nothing off limits to them. And I think that this is why it's been so important to destroy morals. Because when people have morals, then they're more likely to go against this beast system that is in control of us. But because these people in power have absolutely no morals or any scruples about killing anybody or destroying anybody, they want us to have that same level of morality. And so that's why it's been so important for them to... I mean, they're literally banning use of Christian symbols. But if you tried to ban use of Jewish symbols, that would be Judeophobia or anti-Semitism. And if you tried to ban the use of Islamic symbols, that would be Islamophobia. But for some reason, any Christian symbols, they're allowed to ban. And even things like out of the Old Testament, where it says that homosexuality, well, the actual wordings are, if a man lies with a man as he lies with a woman, it is abomination and the penalty is death. It goes on later on to say that they should be stoned to death. Now, if you were to go out and say, I'm a Christian and I'm going to read this passage because this is what was instructed to me by God, you could get arrested in this country. You could be jailed for hate speech. But we live in a world where the word of God is now hate speech. That's how ridiculous it's got. And it should give the audience the real agenda. I mean, I know that they're aware, but it just goes to show when you break it down to that basic level, that the word of God, if you're a Christian, you believe that, is now hate speech. That's how bad it has got. And funnily enough, the ADL, Abraham Foxman, I actually mentioned this in my book, he actually called for, I think it was 2004, that the New Testament in its entirety should be banned as hate speech. literally, this is what he said. So this has all been on the agenda for many years, folks. So I suggest that you also stock up on Bibles as well, because they may be the next thing that they come after. So get hold of Eric's material on his great websites, the links to which will be in the post for the show. Eric, we've got about 20 seconds. Please give the audience your closing statement.
Yeah, well, your points are right on point, Andy. Yeah, Jesus Christ, you know, who is God to a Christian, said, ye are of your father the devil, and his lusts ye will do. Well, this, of course, would be hate speech to a Jew, because he said it to the Pharisees. Pharisees are the same as modern Orthodox Jews in their views. God is an anti-Semite, I guess. Andy, we're just going to have to live with that reality. But of course, anti-Semite term itself is a lie and needs to be deconstructed, because Semitic refers to a group of languages in the Middle East, most of which are spoken by Arabs. So, you know, even anti-Semitic is meaningless.
Thank you, Eric. Excellent contributions today, as always. Eric and I will be back with you in a couple of weeks or so. I want to thank everyone for listening. I'll be back with you all tomorrow, and bye for now.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on the Eurofolk Radio Network. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, in an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.